This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. President Lyndon Johnson ushered in the early efforts to help offset generations of discrimination we now know as affirmative action. Since then, affirmative action has made multiple trips to the U.S. Supreme Court and has been, over the years, assigned a very narrow lane. That lane will eventually hit a dead end. What are the arguments for and against affirmative action? Does affirmative action work? Is it a form of discrimination? And if not affirmative action, then what? What mechanisms should be put in place to help level the playing field for all? Call in with your questions and comments. The number is 210-614-8980. 210-614-8980. Email us at thesource@tpr.org and tweet at us at @tprsource. We're joined this afternoon with Al Kaufman. He's a professor of law at St. Mary's School of Law, Lynn Rambo, professor of law at Texas A&M University Law School, and Scott Jasek. He is the lead editorial operations for Inside Higher Ed, a digital media company serving the higher education space. It's great to have all of you with us this afternoon. And Al Kaufman, let me start off with you. Can you give me your definition of affirmative action?
Well, affirmative action is a process that lets universities or employers look at the whole student in order to promote diversity. The idea is that if they look at all the characteristics of a student, not just their test scores, not just their grades, but their backgrounds, their work history, and they can also consider race, look at all the total student, that will lead to a more diverse student body, which is a real positive in higher education.
Do you see affirmative action as a way to correct wrongs of the past?
I do, personally, but that's really not the way the Supreme Court's going right now. Affirmative action can be based on what they call a history of discrimination or effects of a history of discrimination, and that exists in almost all of our institutions. But the Supreme Court looks at it a little bit differently. They say that you can only use race in order to promote diversity of your student body, and that's an interest that's so important that they will allow universities to use race, national origin as one of many factors when they consider whether to admit a student.
Lynn Rambo at Texas A&M University Law School, your definition of affirmative action, any different than what Al Kaufman's talking about?
Not particularly. I think that it's a program to recognize that as a society we have a whole bunch of different groups, and both racial and ethnic, and it's aimed at inclusiveness of those groups, whether it's in whether it's been in employment or education.
But it's also for gender.
It's also for gender. We certainly have had affirmative action programs in a variety of areas for gender.
Why do you think it's so such a hot topic? I'm sure we're going to get some emotional issues here.
Well, I think it's a hot topic in considerable measure because the majority group in this country is a little uncomfortable with the change in demographics. And so we have been have gotten a little occupied with things that are designed to help our mistakes of the past. Because on the other side of that, we've seen certain situations where minorities and so forth have found themselves in situations where they're facing significant discrimination. So there's been a rise, as everybody knows, in kind of racial polarity in this country. And as that happens, it's really difficult to for some people to accept positive efforts to fix the mistakes of the past.
And Scott Jasek at Inside Higher Ed, trying to fix the mistakes of the past, that's not something that the Supreme Court says that it's actually concerned with. So why do we keep, why do we go there?
Well, one reason is I think a lot of people mistakenly think that all college admissions is on a pure meritocracy, that the smartest, most deserving students somehow get in and there's a list. The reality is there are all kinds of ways that students get in. Some of them get in because they're athletes. Some get in because they're alumni children. On the issue of gender these days, many liberal arts colleges favor male students. In graduate programs in the sciences, Americans are favored over international students. So yes, it is true that colleges do look at race and ethnicity, or many do, but I think part of the reason there's so much discomfort is people imagine a pure meritocracy that does not exist.
So with this Harvard University case that's gotten a lot of attention, that is getting the go-ahead to, and the Justice Department, the Trump administration is joined in the lawsuit. Many people are very anxious to see what is learned in discovery from Harvard University admissions, and they're predicting that we're going to see some things that are not pretty, Scott.
Yes, and indeed we already are. I mean, it is from the documents that have been released, the suggestion is that Asian American students, or applicants, seem to need a higher grade GPA combo to get in than do other students. And this really throws away a lot of the conventional wisdom about affirmative action. One of the reasons I think that the critics of affirmative action abandoned Texas, which used to be their favorite place to sue, is that the dynamics of race relations are different in Texas than in Massachusetts. When people see, because again, people assume it's a pure meritocracy based on some formula, and the reality is what you see at Harvard, Harvard could reject, get so many applicants with perfect GPAs, perfect SAT scores. The reality is it uses what's called holistic admissions, which means looking at each student. And that means that some students who are admitted, and this includes minority students, white students, Asian students, don't have as high grades and test scores as those who are rejected. And so it just doesn't work as neatly as many think.
So it comes down to the question of what is merit? How do we gauge that? Is it more than just a GPA and other issues, you know, doing well in a science fair? So are they going to look, Scott, at what neighborhoods you grew up in?
Yes. In fact, there's a lot of affirmative action based on socioeconomic class. On one side, there are efforts to recruit and admit students who are low-income students. But on the other hand, and this is what people don't talk about, at most colleges, there is great favoritism for so-called full-pay students, meaning those students who don't need financial aid. So again, there is a lot of looking at applicants' socioeconomic background that goes into this, and people don't really like to think about that. People want to assume if you're a wealthier student and you're getting in, that it must be because you're brilliant. And at some places, that might be true. At other places, it might be because they sense that you can afford it.
Wow. Okay, so I'm going to take a break. We have to talk about when students arrive, not just with their, you know, backpack full of goodies, but also with generations of benefits behind them, helping them get to that campus on that very first day, and whether or not there can be an offset put in place using government force and trying to correct that, and if others are being punished because you're trying to help a select class. Even the playing fields. We're going to talk about that when we come back from the break. We want you to call in with your questions and comments. How do you feel about affirmative action? The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. The Source continues right after this. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. For many, the defining moment of their life is when they open up an envelope that they got from a university they applied to, and whether or not it's going to say, congratulations, or we regret to tell you. That's going to be the defining moment. Are you going to go to the Ivy League school and you will enter into an elite area, be able to meet friends and who will help you throughout your life, climb that ladder of mobility, or are you going to not go into that school and this will be a tougher road for you? It's one of those things. So kids go their entire high school shooting for that moment when they got that envelope and when they rip it open. Do they get extra help because of their racial background? And is that right or is it wrong? Or this is something that we should support or we should boo? I don't know. Give us a call. The number is 210-614-8980. We're talking about affirmative action today on The Source. And Jeff has called in. Jeff, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Okay. Yeah, quick question. I think you guys are already touching on it. And obviously nothing is going to solve all of the inequality problems. But it seems to me that if we address finances first and talk about financial inequity, that it irons out a lot of the problems. Not going to solve everything, but boy, it one of the things it does is it irons out a lot of the protests. You know, it's really hard to say, well, this person's being favored over me because of their gender, because of their race. You know, the financial criterion is so much more egalitarian, ultimately, I think.
So paying for tuition, paying for room and board, that type of stuff? Jeff? Okay. All right. I think that's where he went with that. So Al Kaufman, professor at St. Mary's School, do you think that getting a free ride makes a difference?
Well, of course, it always helps. But I think one issue is that people who don't want affirmative action as it's now practiced feel that there are alternatives that would reach the same goal. And one of those is to admit students just on their family income and not consider their race, national origin. And the universities have opposed this because they do want a broad range of people. They want low income and high income. But in addition, statistically, the facts are that even among low income people, the test scores are very different, that white students and Asian students are still scoring much higher on the test scores. So even if you went by family income, that would not lead to a diverse class. And back to your question about merit, the universities have defined merit for themselves. They've said, here's what we want in our class. You said Harvard could fill their first-year class with students who made perfect SAT scores and perfect grades. But instead, they want a diverse environment. And the proof is that learning in a diverse environment is good for all the students in those universities. In addition, they realize that the places at these premier institutions are not only rare but extremely valuable. That if you look at members of this, like the Supreme Court now, all of them went to Ivy League law schools. If you look at the top firms, they have lots of Ivy League people. If you let people into those institutions, they have a long-term benefit in terms of their economic and personal future. But in addition, in terms of merit, I just want to say that all of the students of all races get a real benefit from learning in an environment where they're exposed to people of all different racial and ethnic groups.
Yeah, racial, ethnic groups, gender, and also disability. We've got to make sure that we have all sorts, everyone gets a chance. But Lynn Rambo, can you tell us more about what's being considered? Why is this Harvard case such a big deal?
Well, the Harvard case is a big deal simply because it's another attack on affirmative action at a point in time where we're likely to have a new Supreme Court justice who may put an end to affirmative action. That said, you know, Edward Blum is certainly attacking on several different fronts. And, you know, he has a state case in Texas continuing to attack the University of Texas. But this one is particularly big. Perhaps because its facts are kind of ugly, as you referred to before, but also because it's coming to a head at a time when we have a change on the Supreme Court.
So in Harvard, also, they have a population of students, applicants of Asian ancestry. And the question is whether or not they should be they should limit the number of students to become be granted in, you know, access to the school because they're Asian. Is that right?
Yes. I mean, there's an interesting point that doesn't often get made about this case, and I suspect my panelists may agree. This case is being called about affirmative action, and it may ultimately reach the court on the ground of affirmative action and so forth. But one of the things that the plaintiffs are not doing is they are not explaining how affirmative action in favor of, say, black students or black applicants or Hispanic applicants or other minority applicants is the cause of what's happening with the Asian American students. In other words, it's theoretically about affirmative action because it's about Harvard's use of race. But it's not their letting in of the black and Hispanic students that's having anything to do with why the Asian American students are not getting in.
Scott Jasek,
there's an oddity in that regard.
Okay, at Inside Higher Ed, Scott, tell us about how this operates. And particularly, you know, we mentioned this is they're going to the courts. Texas has got a history with this, with Abigail Fisher. Why do they go to the courts? And why is the court so willing to knock down affirmative action efforts if it's trying to, you know, correct a remedy an injustice?
Well, the Supreme Court has upheld the concept of affirmative action, but in a series of cases only in certain conditions. Only if colleges have considered race-neutral ways to promote diversity. Only if colleges have studied the impact on all students. Only if colleges can show that they are providing the educational benefit of a diverse student body. The tricky thing for Harvard and for everyone else, because a lot of colleges do just what Harvard does in admissions and financial aid, are the numbers. So at Harvard, according to the most recent data, 43% of students are white and 19% are Asian. At the University of California at Berkeley, which can't consider race and ethnicity because the state bans it, 35% of students are Asian and 26% are white. Now, this doesn't show that Harvard discriminates, but what the plaintiffs at the Harvard case are saying is that Berkeley provides a model of what happens when you don't consider race. Now, what they don't draw attention to is that the black numbers go real down. Only about 2% of Berkeley students are African American. So, you know, the numbers play in both ways, and lots of colleges do what Harvard does. So this case would affect Rice and, in some ways, UT. It could affect all kinds of institutions if Harvard loses.
But Al Kaufman, can the Asian student body, whoever's making this case, filing this lawsuit, can they claim harm in their complaint?
Well, they can claim it, but the facts don't support it, because actually Harvard is about 20% Asian students, and Asians are only 6% of the total population. So as a whole, they're just not discriminated against. If you look at African-Americans and Latinos, Latinos are 18% of the population and 10% at Harvard. And African-Americans are 14% of the population and 70% at Harvard, 7% at Harvard. So, in fact, Asians are sort of overrepresented. But again, I don't think Harvard has ever said that, nor can I think it can be shown, that they're doing this to discriminate against Asian-Americans. What they're saying is when they look at every student, they look at their grades, their scores, their background, their work history, their total student. And then they decide we need to diversify our student body, so let's make sure we select people from all of these different groups for everybody's positive education. So I think that's where this case is going to go. One more thing about Harvard, sort of an interesting point. Back in 1978, the U.S. Supreme Court struck down an affirmative action plan, the University of California at Davis, because it had specific targets and goals for minority groups. But they pointed out that Harvard's plan was the excellent example of a plan. And so Harvard's admission plan became the gold standard in the United States. So I think there's some effort behind this to say if we can win against Harvard's plan, we can win against anyone.
So we hear all the time that quotas are bad. That's the thing that the Supreme Court hates, quotas. And so, Lynn Rambo, why are quotas so bad?
Well, quotas have been disapproved ever since the case that Professor Kaufman was talking about, on the ground that if you're actually trying to achieve diversity as your interest, then quotas don't really serve that end. You're not really achieving any kind of diversity because you're really not looking at the person. You're just looking at whether or not they fill a numerical slot. And so the deciding opinion in the Bakke case in 78 said that quotas were unacceptable as a way to further diversity. And that's why we haven't had them, and they haven't been acceptable in affirmative action ever since.
So, and quotas, you know, can you talk more about that, Scott Jasek?
Yeah, sure. I mean, quotas also have an ugly history in American higher education. The plaintiffs in the Harvard case like to compare the treatment of Asians today with the treatment by Harvard and other elite universities of Jewish students in the 1920s. when university leaders explicitly said they didn't want too many Jewish students. So there is a history of quotas being used to hold back certain groups. The other thing you have with a quota is you essentially have separate admissions processes for whoever is in the quota and not. And that's another thing that the Supreme Court has argued, has banned, which is two-tiered admissions. What the Supreme Court, when they upheld the Harvard plan and the Bakke case, what they were saying was holistic admissions, where you look at each person as an individual. The minute you say, we're going to give extra points just for students in groups A and B, you're in legal trouble.
So when we're talking about, you know, looking at the entire person and at merit and not just their grades and their science fair, we're talking about, you know, where they grew up and how were they poverty stricken? Do they have grit? But a lot of the applicants who have Asian ancestry, you know, they're recent immigrants also. They might be first generation American and, you know, they have exhibited grit, Al Kaufman.
Yes, they certainly have. And by the way, this case was brought on behalf of Asian students, but most of the Asian American groups have supported affirmative action. I think, to be honest, this is a small group of Asian Americans bringing this lawsuit. And the reason they have is that for many of the subgroups among the Asian community, it's been very helpful. For people from Southeast Asia have benefited tremendously from affirmative action because they do also come from very poor, low-income families, difficult situations with work, etc. So as a whole, Asians are doing extremely well at Harvard, but the subgroups maybe aren't. But that's what the Harvard committee can look at. They have a committee of 40 people looking at every applicant, and they will consider how the student can do at Harvard and will they bring diversity to the campus. So that might be additionally very beneficial to Hmong students or Lao students.
And Scott Jasek, some people are going to say, well, if the students from Asian background are able to do so well after growing up in poverty and only coming to the United States recently, well, why can't everyone else?
Well, I think it's important to remember there is real discrimination in the United States today. And while some of it is based on poverty, other parts of it are based on race. If you look at where top colleges tend to recruit students, it's not in impoverished areas. If you look at academic excellence, it is harder to achieve in colleges in the high schools with large numbers of students in every class without college counselors to guide them. So there is pervasive inequity, some of it race-based, in our society today. It's also really important to remember, I think, that those who don't get into Harvard, life actually goes on for them. Yes, they're disappointed. But, you know, I'm a Harvard reject. There are lots of Harvard rejects out there who have moved on with life. And I think most people who don't get into Harvard get into another good college and life goes on.
All right. Abigail Fisher went to LSU and graduated. So what are your thoughts on affirmative action? Do you feel like affirmative action has helped or hurt your college applications? Give us a call. We want to hear from you. The number is 210-614-8980. Does affirmative action make America a better nation? Give us a call, 210-614-8980. The Source continues after this break. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Affirmative action is complex. There's a lot of gray areas, and for many, it is deeply emotional. If admissions are based solely on merit, then what is merit? Can growing up poor and educated in a low-performing school district, does that add up? Should that be part of your merit? Or should they just be looking straight at your grades and just saying, okay, you get in and you do not, and look at the Americans as all the same race? Give us a call. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. You can email us at thesource@tpr.org. Scott Jasek, we've heard from the Judge Kavanaugh, as he's gone through his confirmation hearings, that his aspiration is that the court will look at all Americans as if they're from the same race. What would that look like?
Well, many fear it would look like not permitting colleges to consider race. To date, in the past two decisions that upheld affirmative action, Justice Kennedy played a key role. And when I look at the voting records of those who are on the Supreme Court, while you can never predict with 100% certainty, I do not count five votes with Kavanaugh on there that would back this right. So whatever you, whether you think affirmative action is right or wrong, it is definitely in danger right now.
So should we, there be some discussion about if affirmative action runs out of gas, then how do we continue to try to make sure that that we have some opportunities for all in the United States? Lynn Rambo, what else is out there that will survive a court challenge?
Well, I don't know that there are other methods. I mean, certainly a lot of race-neutral measures are what universities are supposed to pursue before they get into considering race, according to Supreme Court precedent. So certainly outreach programs are important, recruiting in areas that would bring in diverse students. All of those things are important. But I don't know that there is anything beyond direct consideration of the backgrounds of students, including what they experience as members of certain races, that would ensure the kind of diversity that schools have wanted. When we in Texas, the history in Texas is that the University of Texas did have something of a two-tiered system, as was referred to earlier. And in 1996, I believe, it was the Hopwood case. And the Fifth Circuit disapproved of that system. And so as a result of that, UT continued with its holistic system. Well, we also had the 10% rule put in place in an effort to help diversify UT. But the number of blacks and Hispanics at UT dropped because there was an inability to consider race. And that's kind of been the history as affirmative action programs have fallen at a number of schools across the country. There have been a couple of places where other efforts have been made and they seem to have taken up the slack. But in most places, I believe the ceasing of affirmative action has caused quite a problem with diversity.
I'm going to go to the phones, 210-614-8980. What are your thoughts? What are your feelings? How have you experienced affirmative action? And Mark is on the line. Mark, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hello. I was calling in because I heard from a report a while ago, and I can't remember the name, that the role of legacy students in admissions to places like Harvard is actually really strongly biased against students of historically underrepresented races like black and Latino students. And that since we have a lot more white legacy students, white people are advantaged in terms of their admissions because they're more likely to be legacy students.
All right, Mark, thank you for the call. Scott Jasek, you should know about this at Inside Higher Ed. Can you help us fill in the blanks?
Yes, the caller is absolutely right. Now, colleges that like legacies, the alumni children, tend to like them of all races and ethnicities, but if you're talking about who a legacy student applicant is today, it is likely the son or daughter of white people. Now, some Asian Americans and some other minority groups actually have been pro-legacy, thinking that we might be reaching the period when all of a sudden non-white legacy applicants would come into play. But when you talk about legacy and also wealth, because it's not just being an alumnus, being the son or daughter of a wealthy alumnus seems to carry particular weight, and you are talking about a small slice of the population.
I've got an email, Twitter from Ashley about affirmative action in the workplace. What kind of affirmative action used at Harvard is different from policies like what we have in San Antonio? We need to ensure that the people that we hire represent the available qualified talent pool based on census data. When it doesn't, that's when we look at the reasons why. So Al Kaufman, you know, businesses, everyone, you know, should be looking at, and who do you hire?
That's right. And I think the history of the – there was a lot of litigation around business plans and city plans as well as university plans. The university law is a little bit different because it specifically upholds the idea of diversity. And diversity in the student body is extremely strong, what they call a compelling interest, supporting the use of race. Now, at the public contracting issues in cities, a little bit different. They have to study their population. They have to study the reasons why there's an underrepresentation of a group. And if they find that that group has been discriminated against by them, then they can use race as a factor. But in general, I think most cities, unless they're under federal rules, avoid using race in any way, although in my mind it probably should be used more in order to diversify the base of contractors and the base of people that the cities and counties work with.
But Scott Jasek, I mean, we've seen with Brett Kavanaugh, the judge who is up for the Supreme Court nomination, I mean, him personally has taken on, hired and brought on and mentored many of the diverse background. And he says this is the way that you ought to do it. Don't use governmental force. We should be doing the right thing on our own.
Well, and actually, that's what Harvard would say it's doing, and that's what many colleges would say they're doing. And it is also relevant, while the law and the Supreme Court cases about employment are different from education, it's important to note that many colleges and universities also actively seek out minority faculty members and report that it's important to them to educate a diverse student body. You also need diverse perspectives and diverse backgrounds on the faculty. So this does matter. The Kavanaugh comments are really interesting in that a lot of people, I think, intuitively are uncomfortable with the prospect that leading universities might be all white or all white and Asian and want to see some level of diversity. Where it gets complicated is what you do to bring that about.
It seems like, you know, the expectation for someone who, if you get rid of affirmative action, and if you're poor and you have a minority background and you show up, and you've got to be perfect in order to compete at that level. You can't have one bad semester. You can't have totally, you know, fallen off the track at one point and tried to get back on. It seems like it's pretty incredible standards that we have for individuals that we expect people to pull themselves up by their bootstraps, Scott.
Yeah, well, and it's not just having a bad semester. It's the opportunities. If you go to a wealthy high school, you can take 10 AP, more than that, the advanced placement courses. You can have enrichment. Your parents take you abroad, and you have all kinds of experiences that if you go to a low-income high school, you flat out don't have. Somebody at a high school without advanced courses, without AP courses, even if he or she is doing the best he or she can, you don't have the same opportunities. So this isn't just about blowing it for a semester. It's about chances that some students have and some students do not have.
I want to follow up on Scott's comment.
Okay, all right, Al Kaufman.
It's very, very important, and I support that. I worked in California for a short time, and in California, you could fill the top UC schools, UCLA, UC Berkeley, with students who have 4.2 and above GPAs, even though 4 is perfect, 4 is all A's. So how they get 4.2s? Because they took AP courses, and they took all AP courses. You get extra points for those. So many students were never at a school where they could do that. And when you talk about opportunities, there's no doubt that families who've had wealth and power for many generations, you know, help their students understand the system much better and give them innate advantages on things like test scores. And that's why I want to minimize the use of test scores.
Sure, if you got parents that listen to NPR, you know, you're in the back seat and the car seat, you're gonna pick some things up. Lynn Rambo, you wanted to add?
Yeah, I just wanted to add to Scott's comments that, you know, 49% of minorities in Texas attend high poverty schools. You know, many of the students that are getting into the University of Texas under the 10%, which is now less than 10% program, you know, are coming from schools that are entirely minority. And they have a hard time when they get there because they don't have that background of preparation by parents and generations before them to sort of help them navigate the road.
And so, Lynn, we need a way to how do you fix that? I mean, I've got less than a minute before I got to go to break. We'll come back. We'll talk about some other ways that, if not affirmative action, then what can be done to help students get into the Ivy League or to UT or A&M, wherever it is that they want to go. The number to call in is 210-614-8980. Charisse, hang on. I'll get you. You're on the board. We'll get you on the air right after this break. The number to call in is 210-614-8980. We're talking about the past, present, and future of affirmative action in America. Stay tuned. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Who are the leaders of the future? Who are the judges, the Supreme Court deciders, the people who make it into the White House? Where do they come from? What were their backgrounds? What's their frame of reference? By having some sort of method in order to ensure that we have a pathway of diversity into the best schools in the nation, so they have able to get into those top positions. You know, we want people who grew up working cattle and baling hay and dealing with issues in the gritty streets of America. It can't all be coming from one place, you know. So how do we do that? And how do we do that in a way that will pass muster with the U.S. Supreme Court? The number to call in is 210-614-8980, and Charisse is on the air. Charisse, welcome to The Source. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you very much. I wanted to give a positive story about affirmative action. So it was very long ago. I started college in 1987. I'm Hispanic, and I had very good grades, probably lousy test scores, and I got accepted to UC Santa Barbara for college and struggled for a long time, but eventually did really well. I'm not 100% certain that affirmative action is what got me there, although I was often the only person in the room that was Hispanic, so it wouldn't surprise me. And then I went to Yale for a graduate degree. Again, I don't know if that was affirmative action, but definitely I'm sure that helped. And then went on to a PhD in biology at Notre Dame. And all of those experiences, I recognize that I would not have had those advantages. In addition to affirmative action, I had scholarships that were for minorities. All of that has led me to have a need to give back to my community. Most of my professional life has been investing in the community and in those populations that don't have those resources that might come from a background like mine that was low income. You know, I'm a first generation college student, and my children are in SAISD in a high poverty school. And while my own kids will probably do fine, they've got two educated parents, a lot of their classmates come from very, very different backgrounds or backgrounds similar to the one that I grew up in. And I want to make sure that they have those same opportunities. And affirmative action really helps them to do that. I wouldn't have had those opportunities otherwise.
Charisse, thank you so much for calling in with that positive story. Let me go over to Scott Jasek at Insight Higher Ed. You know, affirmative action, some people, you know, who deride it, see it as a free ride for some people. But is it that, or is it just a chance? Otherwise, a chance that many people would not have.
I certainly don't think it's a free ride, which doesn't mean there aren't criticisms that are valid. The reality is, to get into one of these top places, you have to be an exceptionally talented young person. And that's whether there is or isn't affirmative action, whatever your race or ethnicity. Generally, what you're talking about with affirmative action is after students have already made a cut, after the colleges have already figured out who could do the work here, who could excel here. It is not like they're letting in unqualified students who will fail. Frankly, colleges don't want students who will fail. So the free ride thing, I think, is a little unfair, particularly when you think of the advantages that wealthier students have.
Let's go to Joseph on the board. Joseph, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Yes, I just wanted to put in an understanding that affirmative action has changed over time. Lately, I have relatives that try to get into medical schools, so we reviewed all those qualifications for affirmative action and minorities and disadvantaged minorities. And it seems that medicine might be having the answer, because when you're looking for affirmative action, you're looking for something that has a positive, what's called a positive good, a positive social good. It's not the idea that you're repairing any injustices from the past. It's not the idea that you're trying to increase diversity in the classroom. But then in the end, you want to produce physicians that somehow reflect the population better. Because there is a general understanding that people respond better to doctors who look or speak as they do compared to somebody who doesn't. And so in that way, affirmative action, at least for medical school, seems to be to support this public good.
All right, Joseph, thank you for that call. And you make a good point. Al Kaufman from St. Mary's Law School.
Well, I wanted to follow up on that because it is very important. Legally, the Supreme Court hasn't supported that as a unique support for affirmative action, though, what some people call the role model theory, although it's very important. That's one reason we stress it. The fact is that a Latino bilingual poor student from San Antonio who goes to medical school is much more likely to practice and be sensitive to her community than someone who's not. And now, there's not a perfect example, but someone who's not. And the same thing in the law, in other professions. All of these folks who come from these backgrounds really are good for society when they go back. They're aware of the issues and they're sensitive to it. They're also role models so that other kids growing up can see, hey, there's a Latino doctor, there's an African-American lawyer, et cetera. Those are all very important factors.
Lynn Rambo at Texas A&M University Law School. I mean, the court has said affirmative action is allowed if it fits a compelling government interest, and then it has to have a narrow, have a high level of scrutiny in order to meet that interest, right?
Yes. And I'd love to explain that for people listening. Essentially, whenever an organization, be it a government or a school or whatever, engages in classifying people on the basis of race, that triggers the Equal Protection Clause under the 14th Amendment or under the 5th Amendment if it's federal. And it's not that immediately it's found unconstitutional. What happens is that that puts the burden on that government or school to come forth with a compelling reason they're doing this and to show that they're doing it as narrowly as possible to fit that reason. And what's happened in affirmative action is that in employment, in contracting, in set-asides, the court has said that the only reason to do it is to remedy past discrimination. And boy, do you have to show a whole lot of stuff about past discrimination if you're going to do it. So much stuff that almost no one engages in employment and business affirmative action anymore. In the education arena, the court has said there's basically one reason we'll allow you schools to do this, and that is diversity in the classroom.
Why is that so important? Why is that a goal worthy?
Well, because it's shown significant educational benefits.
Okay, let me go to another caller.
Being introduced to the perspectives of all other people. For example, in law school, it's terrific for kids to see kids from other cultures precisely because they will have clients of those cultures.
Right, and that's why it shows it's great to have people of disability in there as well, all sorts of people from rural and urban. You know, we need a mix of individuals. Let's go to Seth. And Seth, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you so very much, Mr. Davies. Real quick, based upon, this is for the numbers people out there, based upon an estimated population of 385 million people in the U.S. and 12% to 13% African-American and everybody else, that only brings a college-educated person, assuming there's like 25% people who have a college degree, that's only 1 million people who are black who have college-educated degrees versus 97 million other people who are not black who have college-educated degrees. That's a huge gap, 97 million versus 1 million. And I think that's very important to point out and concentrate on how to close that gap. And African Americans in the U.S. have only had like about 40 to 45 years of time to get to that level. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Seth, thank you so much for bringing that up. Let me go to Scott Jasek about that. And so, shouldn't it be in the government's best interest to make sure that we shore that up, that there's some balance and some representation there?
Absolutely. And this is what many educators are saying, that we as a nation will be worse off if we don't have talent from all groups. And it's really important to remember that as a nation, we have rejected and held back the talent of many groups. These days, a majority of college students are women, but for decades, women were denied equal opportunity. Certainly, African Americans were legally denied equal opportunity, and of late, because of the underfunding of high schools that they and that a disproportionate number enroll in, are denied equal opportunity. We are hurt as a society if we don't have more black teachers and lawyers and doctors and professionals of all kinds. So, yes, but I'm not sure that's the argument that the Supreme Court is accepting, which is much more based on the what goes on in the classroom and the educational benefits of having a diverse environment there.
So it would surprise few if the Supreme Court strikes down affirmative action in the next few years. What to do then, Al Kaufman, to try to reach what we almost universally accept, that we need to have representation, in these positions? How do we deal with that?
Well, so far, no one's come up with a really good alternative, but I do agree that you look at the income of the student is important. Look at the work factors. Remove some of the advantages of legacies. If your parents went there, you get to go there. Intense recruiting focused on the high schools that produced the most poor students and the most minority students, that is still available. So those are the only things I can think of. The problem is statistically, people have found that those things don't add up to the same effect on diversity as being able to use race. And you mentioned the California example. In California, once the people just passed an amendment saying you can't use race at all in colleges, their number of African Americans and Latinos plummeted. And African Americans are down around 1 or 2%, Latinos about 5 or 6% in states that are about 40% Latino and 15% African American. So it just makes no sense in terms of the people living in those communities.
All right, Al Kaufman, professor at St. Mary's School of Law. Also with us this afternoon, we were joined by Lynn Rambo, professor of law at Texas A&M University Law School, and Scott Jasek. He is at Inside Higher Ed, a digital media company that serves the higher education space. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks so much for tuning us in.